listening to the Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, Crossing the Sound, a record of a journey taken by the poet Gerald Daw from Galway City to Achill in 2019. Gerald, who was a frequent and generous contributor to this and other programmes, died earlier this year. This is Crossing the Sound.
Memory. It is a desert of rock. The rain has finally withered, till we are left black dots on a shrinking island. We come like pilgrims, wandering at night through the dim landscape. A blue horizon lurks behind wind bushes and narrows to pass the pitch black valley. We are at home. A place as man forsaken as this must carry, like the trees, a silent, immaculate history. Stones shift under the cliff's shadow. Nearby, the tide closes in, master of the forgotten thing. So here we are in Galway, in Eyre Square, and I remember I was a young 22-year-old entering into the square on the bus, and that was the beginning of a new phase of my life. I'd left Belfast behind, and I didn't quite know what lay in front of me, but it was to become actually my life, and it's great to be back here to walk around the streets that I started to get to know back then. St. Nicholas's was our local church. We lived literally two steps away from here in Abbeygate Street. And in 1981, it was where our daughter was christened. Reverend Leslie Forrest, who was the minister at the time, became a very close and dear friend of ours, and his wife, Avril. It's quite an imposing but intimate church. And it has this wonderful sense of family and connection to the city going back through many centuries. It has, as you can see, one would see in the walls here, its associations with the Protestant community going back through hundreds of years. There are tablets here referring to men who fought in the Crimea in World War I, and the community that it drew towards it from far afield and throughout what was then the British Empire. But now it's very much an Irish church in Galway, and it has a feeling of community life about it. We loved it, and outside the church, going back through time, there was an open fair. Some of the wonderful photographs taken outside of the church, you can see the people from Connemara and Clada and so on gathering to sell their wares. So it's got a historical relationship to Galway, but it also, back in time, connects in with so much else of Irish and British history. The bells of St. Nicholas. The bells of St. Nicholas reverberate through a fragile morning. And over broken glass, the cat is poised to climb the post office tower or wait there for hours until you call out her name. So, mornings were the same, stretching to find the sky lowered around the sleeping city. The bells of St. Nicholas reach across bed sitting rooms to the caravan camps, and over rooftops of quiet hotels, a flight of gulls descend in tattered glory. Plan is I'm going to be talking with friends and colleagues from the 70s and 80s. I'll be meeting with Tom Kenny of the famous Kenny Art Gallery and Bookshop, Judy Murphy, wonderful journalist with the Connacht Tribune, and one of Galway's best known actors, Cathy Belton.
I
I arrived in Galway, Cathy, in 1974. I was a 22-year-old. But you grew up here. What was it like?
Galway was like no other place I've ever been in or visited since. I don't think I would have been an actor if I hadn't come from Galway. Culture, arts, literature, it was in the fabric of the city. Everywhere you looked, there you were reminded of writers. I remember my dad used to take me on driving lessons out to Tour Ballylee, and that's how I learned about Yeats, as he was ranting poems as we drove and he taught me. The same with Coole Park. I remember as kids, that's where we picnicked. So you looked at the autograph tree and all the stories came out. And I think there's a great thing about Galway people. They speak in stories, they communicate in stories. I think, personally, that's to do with the weather. Mm. A lot of the time, it never stops raining in Galway. We huddle a lot around fires. So I think we tell a lot of stories because we're still and we have to keep warm. And even if you walk down Shop Street, you know, you meet people, they'll always have a story or the character, like Mrs. Taff outside Taff's. So growing up in Galway was like growing up with a lot of storytellers, certainly personally within my family.
And was the theatre there at that stage?
Yes.
I mean, was it the Tyveoc or had Druid?
Druid was in its prime, the Murphy years. One of the first plays I ever saw was Conversations of a Homecoming. I remember coming out into Druid Lane and deciding, I want to do that. The magic was there. But the big thing, Gerald, was that it wasn't going to the theatre. It wasn't a Lily thing. Everybody went to the Druids. That's what you did. Mm. And I can still remember my mom sitting around the kitchen table the next day with all the neighbours talking about the Tom Murphy playing the Druid. It was part of what you did.
Yeah, I mean, the way you talk there, you get a sense that the theatre, like some of the other arts, the visual arts in Galway and in the West, that it was much more available, much more accessible.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, of course, became the big buzzword for then the arts festival started and so on.
And we were getting to see world-class international acts. I remember seeing the French big theatre company Royal Deluxe in the Cathedral car park as a kid. You would never see that, you know. And that's when the Galway Arts Festivals, they opened up the world to Galway. I often think that Galway is like a big parish of arts. No, and that's what it is, and everybody's connected.
From Land of Dreams. The tourist guide in Pony and Trap passes Moon's Corner as some kids sing, "Oh Lord, it's so hard to be humble." "You'd not see the likes of that in Utopia," he quips. One bright spring day, the shopkeeper looks both ways. "Feckin' massive," is what he says. Aloft, red-lipped Una Taff whelps at her stockingless feet, sweeps all before her, as the patrician brass band, caps and instruments, flood my room in waves of light, sound waves, like falling asleep.
I know that I only met you many years after, when I had the great joy and honour of being taught by you in Trinity College, not knowing that you lived in Galway. Mm. How long did you live in Galway?
I moved here in 1974.
And what brought you to Galway?
Well, it's like some of the things we were talking about. I was intrigued by the literature of the 19th century, and there was an academic in UCG, as it then was, called Lorna Reynolds, and she was the expert of the time on this 19th century fiction. So I arrived in the bus in Eyre Square with my suitcase, and I stayed in a hotel just up there. I think it's long gone, the Imperial.
Yeah.
I stayed in there and walked up to UCG. I'd been there once before the preceding year, and it was actually that journey that the first time in 1973, I just thought, what an absolutely stunning place. And the thing that really struck me about it was, we've got the vast Atlantic on our shoulder, but it was the canal ways that I loved.
Yeah.
And the car running through. I mean, it's a hugely romantic city.
Yeah, it is.
So I settled there then, and in due course met the girl, as she was then, who then became my wife.
In Galway.
In Galway, yeah. She was also in UCG. She's from Mayo, but I met her in, what was the bar called? The Tavern in Eyre Square.
Oh, my God.
Which was where people used to hang out in those days.
Okay.
It was either the Tavern or the Cellar or the Castle Hotel, which was famous for, it was a home for
people from Arran going back and forward. So those were my pods of activity,
right.
The tavern, the cellar and the Castle Hotel. And then, of course, family started to come along and we settled there, first of all, in the city centre, in the middle of Galway. And then we moved out to Ballandooley, out in the Tuam Road.
Yes, yeah.
And then we ended up in Corandulla, out towards the place my mother insisted on calling Tuam. Tuam, Tuam. It sounded like something from India or something. A typical spring-like day in Galway. It's balmy, but it's wet. And we're standing outside Nora Barnacle's house. The story goes that James Joyce sent in his son Giorgio into the house in Bowling Green to make sure that he was welcome. He stood at the railings outside St. Nicholas's Church, and I imagined him in a poem called In Memory of James Joyce. I imagined him seeing him there, tapping his foot, anxiously waiting for word that he was allowed into the house. Nora, his wife, his partner, and then ultimately his wife, was from the town, and she lived here for a while before moving to Dublin, where the famous meeting of minds and bodies happened between James and Nora. And his associations with Galway through Nora intrigued me. In Memory of James Joyce, Bloomsday, Galway, 1987. Just thought I'd drop you a line, given the fact that I happen to be walking the same streets as you once did. It was, of course, raining, and down by Nun's Island the houses faded to a faint pointless light. At the derelict mill up for sale, schoolgirls in greys and blacks sped past with U2 badges on racing bikes. They'll keep going till they are far from Rahoon, Well Park and Castle Lawn. The pity is, would it have been any different if they had known about your woman Nora, or how you both managed moving from flat to flat and put their country on the map of a mostly indifferent universe? Heading into town, the Caroline is like the road in the Great Gatsby, except the billboard here is the dump. Every house is an El Dorado, while an ancient tower teeters on the brink. So much for the past. We must make our own choices and live with them, immaculate blinds and ornamental brasses, as the Corrib seeps into glinting lakes. What would you think of the new estates hugging either shore, or the telecom mast picking up our fervent calls across the water to a son that's gone or a daughter? I tip my hat as you pass by, a preoccupied man in shabby gutties. So Nora was there, and she becomes, in his mind, this wonderful recreated woman called Molly Bloom. Mm.
It's kind of steep, though, when you look at Nora B. Like, yes. I remember visiting her house very young and then becoming, well, the dead and Michael, yes, buried in Rahoon Cemetery. And again, I remember my dad showed me John Huston's film, The Dead. And then going, my God, we go up every cemetery Sunday to Rahoon Cemetery, and that's where Michael, her love, is buried.
Yes.
We're living within these stories. We're, yeah, living within these lives of these, yeah, writers.
I mean, Nun's Island was, I remember walking along. Unfortunately, it was a raining day.
No surprises
no
there,
no surprises
Gerald.
There. But I remember thinking, it's in one of these houses that Greta thinks back to,
yes,
and Michael is, yes, out in the
roaring up at her.
Yeah. And the Corrib is flowing down the,
yes,
back.
Yes.
So, I mean, it was not something that was detached from you. You almost feel you could touch
yeah,
the story. You,
yeah,
could touch the wall. You could touch the river, you know?
And again, reminding us the influence and the power Nora had over James Joyce.
Oh, yes.
Do you know, she was his muse.
Oh, utterly. And the other thing that I love the story about, I mean, I never read any of Jimmy's books. But now that I have you here, we've been talking back and forward over the last while about Talking of Dreams. Would you read a piece from it?
It would be my absolute pleasure. Do you want to introduce it?
I should. Talking of Dreams is Molly speaking into the 21st century, really. And I kind of imagine her in this piece as a modern woman mm-hmm. who is in bed with her husband, and she is thinking back over her life. And the piece which you're going to read for us is the end of it.
When we were young, not a care in the world, we'd go off, and it didn't matter where or when. I was carrying the second one, sitting on the rocks, and the sun was hot for the time of year. And he just got into the water and swam around me, because I couldn't swim then. I just rest myself in the water and float in the tide. The rocks had lovely little flowers all around them. Jasmine, I'd say, maybe, or some kind of wild roses. And a few fields where cattle, fine cattle they were too, grazed around a castle, I think it was, or a tower. It was long empty anyhow, and falling down, and the hedges were full of little sparrows and the loveliest little primroses. And I thought, this is it. But you can never tell the way things go. You have to make the most of it, or else it would drive you bammy. He was like a suitor. That's the word. A suitor who had come from another world. I remember that well. But he didn't know, or if he did, he didn't say, not then anyway. Maybe later on, in his own way. He never knew all the things I was thinking. How could he?
That's the boundary now. I think we need to go to the far end. That's the boundary. Yeah, that's...
Well, that's Kenny's.
Yeah. That's Kenny's boundary, but it's the bookshop, the arts... the art.
That's up the other side, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have to go left and right again.
I think so.
I may be wrong, no, but I have to go.
Yeah.
My mother came from Leitrim to Galway to college, and she met my father on her first day, and that was that. As he always said... They wanted to get married, they fell madly in love, they graduated from college, they had no money, it was during the war, they had no prospects, there was no point in emigrating much either, and somebody gave them the idea of opening a bookshop. Now, they both loved books and reading, etc., but it was a kind of an act of madness, to be honest. But that's what they did. In 1940, they opened a second-hand bookshop with all of their own books, books they borrowed and were given from members of the family, their friends, and so on. And the first kind of small extension of the shop was when they bought a house in Salt Hill. And they moved out of the back of the bookshop. That's where I was born, in the back of the bookshop. My mother then, in the late 40s, introduced crafts into the shop to try and inject some colour into it. And as it happened in 1953, an artist called Kenneth Webb arrived at the top of the street. He was looking at it. How would he paint this? And he came in and a conversation started with my mother, and she told him about the crafts, and he said, well, why not original artworks as well?
Tell us a little bit about the writers who associated themselves with the bookshop.
Yeah, well, the one constant it had for 66 years was my mother. She simply loved books, but she read books as well, and she could be very highly critical of books. And the result was that even from the very early days, writers would come and visit. People like Ethel Mannan, Frank O'Connor. Frank O'Connor came in once, the first time, and my mother didn't know who he was. And he asked her, who was the best short story writer in Ireland? And yeah, that's a ridiculous question. Sure, there are three outstanding, Liam O'Flaherty, Frank O'Connor, Sean O'Fallon, and he went, phew, and he stormed out the door. And the following day, she opened the paper and saw his photograph and realised who he was. Now, his daughter has since howled with laughter at this story and said, no, grumpy old yo, etc., etc.
Yes.
He was one. Eric Cross, Brendan Behan, Walter Macken was our uncle. He came in every week, at least once a week. And the wonderful thing about him was he always took two or three books home to read. But when he came back, he critiqued them. He told us that there was beautiful writing in this, that there was a wonderful plot, character building in this, etc., etc. And all of this was obviously being infused into our brains a little bit. We were learning without realizing it. Kate O'Brien was another. She used to do the same. She would come in from Roundstone and burst in the door of the shop after lunch with her publisher. Here comes Kate, full of port. And she'd pick a book off the shelf, and she might have been full of port, but boy, could she talk, and talk about the books and the writers and the scandal and so on.
There was also so many events that took place, book launches.
Well, a lot of that came later. I mean, they started really with some exhibitions, but you're quite right. Later in the 60s and 70s, it was a constant stream of book launches, of readings, of artists or writers coming in simply to do book signings, that kind of thing. But what it was doing was making the artist, the writer, accessible to the public and vice versa.
Well, I'm here in the offices of the Connacht Tribune in Market Street in Galway. I'm just going to head in and meet Judy Murphy, the assistant editor of the newspaper.
When I first came here, it was to college, and that was from 1981 to 84. And I had come from the next county down, County Clare. And it was just a revelation in a way, even though it was such a small town at the time, relative to what it is now with nearly 90,000 people. There was such a culture of music, and the Druid Theatre was probably, it was in its very early days at that stage, and the Dramsock in college and all the various kind of the societies in college, there was such a vibrancy. And if you wanted to be part of it, it really was, it was open to you to be part of it. And I just remember really loving that and the energy that was around here. And even though at the time places like Key Street and Middle Street, they were all really quite dilapidated. A lot of the areas around there were dilapidated. There was still a great energy around Galway.
And it was kind of propelled by people from the city and from those who arrived, like yourself, from outside of the city.
Yeah, I mean, when I came here first, there would have been people like you, people like Mickey Gorman, people like Ollie Jennings, groups like Mocknes, Druid, at the Arts Festival, obviously. And it made Galway a place where people wanted to come.
Let's try and be a bit more specific then. I mean, in relationship to, say, two or three of the art forms, let's take theatre, literature, and music. I mean, how open have these been?
Theatre, definitely. And musically, Galway has always embraced musical visitors, and it's always attracted. I mean, it's a huge traditional scene here, but there's all kinds of other scenes here as well. There's a fantastic classical music scene here now. And then there's world music and there's jazz. So it's a very exciting kind of a city in that regard.
What writing comes to your mind when you think about writing in Galway?
I suppose one would be Mike McCormack, who lingered for so long in the shadows after his early initial success, put the work in and kept his head down and didn't give up on the dream. There's Lisa McInerney, there's Nuala O'Connor, there's, of course, Michael Gorman, who is still creating poetry. We have the playwrights like Christian O'Reilly, who has done great work since he started off with Druid and has become part of the Galway landscape in terms of producing work for companies like Blue Teapot that work with intellectually disabled people. There's publishing houses. The dynamism is still here, for absolute sure. The dynamism is here.
I arrived in here from Belfast in 1974. Say you were coming from Sarajevo in 1994 or 2004. How would you fit in?
Well, interestingly, I was reading recently, and we have, as a city, Galway has the highest proportion of immigrants in the country. It's the most multicultural city. And I kind of like that. And you see that on the streets. You really do. It is an international city. And I suppose being on the edge of the Atlantic or by the Atlantic, we've always kind of looked out for it because you had to survive. And I think that brings a vibrancy to the place. Having said that, it can be insular and people who are here can protect their territory, and that isn't unusual, I suppose. But what I do find, and particularly among the younger generation, there's an incredible generosity and a support. You see it with people like the Galway Theatre Festival, which is a fantastic organisation. And the support network among the different groups involved in that is really kind of gratifying to behold. And it makes you positive and confident of the future.
And if you were put to the pin of your collar, what one important development would you see necessary for Galway to develop artistically?
The biggest resource we have is the people. And I think we really need to look after the people. And it doesn't mean throwing money at them for nothing, but the people who are there, who are contributing and who are experimenting and sometimes succeeding and sometimes failing, they need to be supported because they give us that vision that we wouldn't otherwise have. We obviously need a proper theatre space. We need a proper concert space, which we don't have. We need a municipal gallery, which we don't have. And it's quite extraordinary that these are all things we were discussing in the 1980s and we're still discussing them. And there's a huge amount of lip service paid by politicians to the arts and to the arts in Galway. But really and truly, in terms of putting their money where their mouths are, they don't seem to follow through on it. And I really think it's a great pity, because when you mention Galway to people, they associate it with the arts. And the arts have lifted Galway way, way beyond its level as a small city and given it an international reputation.
We're at the river, the Corrib River, as it flows out of the loch towards the Claddagh Basin. And just by us here is the O'Brien's Bridge. It's a famous bridge in many ways for the fact that it was over this bridge people from Connemara would travel into the city and else with produce for sale. When I moved here first, it was known as a bridge that took you literally to the streets just over the way called the West. As you move down from where we're standing at O'Brien's Bridge, you're literally leaving Ireland in many ways. The Corrib flows into the basin and into the Atlantic, and then its next stop after the Aran Islands, it's America. So it's a very dramatic landscape. And I recall when I moved here first, being very taken by it. I loved this spot. It's been refurbished since I was here. And some of the famous houses, such as just across the way from us here in Nuns Island, these houses are now being taken back into life again. It's great to see. But one Sunday morning, I was heading down the west, as it was called, and I saw a great musician crossing the bridge. We were both, let's say, a little worse for the Saturday night wear, and the Corrib was in full spate, an extraordinary sight. The river was literally smashing in against the bridge, and we kind of steered one another across. When I came back to Galway 40 years later, I recall that image, and I wrote this poem, Mickey Finn's Air, in honour of Mickey Finn, a great fiddler and musician, but also it's a kind of love song to Galway.
Mickey Finn's Air. A big wind bowls down the salmon weir and hits the pair of us on O'Brien's Bridge. These little islands you forget all about. Inlets, isthmuses, promontories, canal and walkways and ridges between one thing and another. Heading west is not so easy this day. We hesitate in the wind and squally rain, catch a breath and guide each other across the unshakable bridge of fast, foaming waters.
So I'm leaving Galway behind and heading out towards Connemara to meet the artist, Padraig Rainey. It's such a contrast when you leave behind the intimacies of inner city Galway. Suddenly you begin to hit out towards Connemara as the landscape opens out and unfolds, and it's a very, very dramatic landscape too. It's the kind of place that once seen, never forgotten. My first exposure to it was in 1973-74, and I remember very clearly the
sheer shock of seeing this landscape. It was remarkable for a city boy. This new look, this completely different landscape, I tried to capture in a poem which I wrote back in the early 80s. The poem's called Road Ahead. Mesmeric window wipers punctuate our talk of politics that is lost in the mountain pass, shadowed by the last village, derelict bog. Our voices jabber about what's past, while habitual eyes fix on the road, winding blindly ahead.
Porrick, when did we meet? It was sometime in the 70s, wasn't it?
I'd say it was around the mid-70s, would it? Yes, you were in Galway at the time and I was in the RTC, or, you know, at the time doing art. And I think that
was
the beginning. As a student, yes.
Yeah. I mean, things were beginning to bubble up by the end of the 1970s on the arts front here.
It was really was the beginning, I think, you know. Yes, there was very, very little happening in the arts around that time. There was the Kinney Gallery at the time. That was the only vision. And that one was in Salt Hill. Later on in the 80s, early 80s, the Stone Art Gallery opened in Spittle. So that opened up another, especially for me, another area to show.
Jesus, what was his name?
Jesus Modia.
Jesus Modia,
The
70s were a moment when Galway actually sort of took off. The art scene started to develop.
I agree.
The literary scene started to develop.
Yes, I suppose with the Galway Arts Festival, we started the Western Artists group thing, which was huge. And a lot of things were started up by ourselves that time. It was a matter of finding another store, shed, whatever, clean it out and put on the show. And that went on for years doing that.
But am I right in saying that you were one of the very few home-based or local artists? You were from Connemara.
Dismac McGovock, he was art critic for the Irish Times at the time, said that as many artists went to Connemara, he felt that was the first to come out, be born there as an artist. You know, I never looked this up myself, but he obviously did.
And, I mean, you went almost immediately then into being a full-time artist, professional artist, presenting your paintings in Galway. And then sort of around the time, other artists started to settle in Galway.
Yes, a lot of artists came in. You know, that was, I'd say, the time that Breen Burke and John Behan and people like Jay Murphy and that came in and stayed, kind of thing, yeah.
Going back through the 30 or more years, whatever it is, I mean, did you find it a hospitable place to be as an artist? Did you ever have the sense that you wanted to leave, that you needed to leave, or...?
No, I never had that sense of wanting to leave, go be somewhere else. I didn't want to leave the landscape. I didn't want to leave Connemara, really, because when it comes to it, and still is, it's the place I go out in the bog when I need peace, look at it on my own. It's kind of like people say when you go sailing or on the boat, everything seems to stop now. No matter what happens, you're away from it. You can't do anything about it. I get the same thing being out in the bog. And I love it, especially in winter when the colours change completely and you get that kind of, on the lakes, that beautiful, strong blues.
So the landscape actually really gives you exactly what you need.
Yes.
It's the colour, it's texture, it's the dramatic relationship between sky and land, water.
Yes.
Yeah.
The other thing that is wonderful, you know, when you think about where I am, I have South Connemara, North Connemara, and they are very different in the landscape. Same distance I have Inishmore, the three islands, Inishere, Inishmeon, and the Burden. And they are so different to each other. You get the bog, the granite, the acid soil, to the limestone. The changes in the colours, plants, textures, everything is so different. But they're all within 20 minutes from where I live.
Poem. You deal in barren landscapes of an ice-born Atlantic, where the trees are all bent and scattered birds reel. That is your own place, going back as if something, an heirloom or memory, had been lost or misplaced. Watching the mountains no one has crossed. Whatever you came for does not remain. I mean, one of the things that has always drawn me to your art has been the kind of imagery that you use. I mean, when we did Crossing the Sound, poems and paintings from the west of Ireland, poetry by Gerald Daw, paintings by Porrick Rini, with a preface by Hugo Hamilton, the image that goes alongside autobiography of the ram's horns. I mean, this isn't realistic art. You're transposing into another level, aren't you?
Yes, and it's hard for me to explain in words, but the painting and the ram's head, they're both from an Ishark. And the way I split the painting up, which I really can't explain why, but it's something that it's not getting there until I start doing things like that with it. I did the drawings of the houses. I recorded really in drawing what was there exact. Then I started having time to look around more at other things. And one of the things that was showing up on the island is all these dead sheep and skulls around the place. So I decided to use them as well in it. It's kind of maybe saying the death of an island in another way, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it comes across very much in all of your artwork that you are recording and noting how a civilization or a culture is vanishing, but it doesn't vanish because it lives in your art.
I hope so, yes.
I'm leaving behind Galway now and heading into County Mayo. Our ultimate destination will be Achill Island, where I'll be seeing the artist John McHugh. En route, we're going to drop into Westport, the wonderful Westport, where I'm going to meet with the poet, a very fine prose writer as well, Sean Lycett. Mayo is very dear to my heart. It's where my wife is from. It's where I spent many, many years visiting in Ballina and travelling around, discovering the county of Mayo. I remember one particular day back in the 80s. It was a Sunday, I remember, and I was thinking of her driving through a rather autumnal day. It was raining, and I wrote this poem called Interstices, I hear some people refer to it, about 1980s Mayo. Rain spatters down, confirming our distance. You could be miles away, driving by the boxed fields and other slopes than these that I gape at all day, where bungalows of the newly rich survey within strategic bush, telegraph poles that pierce the secluded reach of silence. You could be travelling through the pothole lanes of Mayo, rounding a hill to the signposted cemetery, figures of Christ called on top, and adamant crosses over lesser graves, oblivious of the cracked flagstone floor, the broken down dresser and dank disheveled bed. But down the next corner, your mind is lulled by miraculous trees, the sky flailing its inevitable horizon. I've been on this journey, Sean, traveling through the west of Ireland, retracing a little journey of my own, going back to the 70s. How do you read the phrase? What does it mean to you, the West of Ireland?
Well, if you look back at the origins of that idea, I suppose you could take it back to the Romantic period and when Wordsworth's writings begin to kind of filter through into the Irish tradition. It's there as well in the kind of sentimental literature of the 18th century, isn't it? And then if you look at a writer like Lady Morgan, who was absolutely saturated in the European tradition, she comes to the West and she writes her book, The Wild Irish Girl.
When is it set?
1806 it was published, just after the Act of Union.
Mm.
So the young Horatio, her English protagonist, is being sent to the west of Ireland to devote himself to his legal studies because he's kind of gone off the rails and his father's worried about him. So his father sends him off to his Irish estate, and Horatio goes out there with average prejudices and so on. But all of his prejudices are contradicted by what he meets. And he meets the daughter of the Irish chieftain. She's Glorvina. He thinks of her as a kind of a Wordsworthian Lucy out there in the wilds. And gradually he discovers that she's actually reading periodic literature from London. And she's reading all of these continental novels that the priest, who of course has been educated on the continent, has brought back to her. So from being the wild Irish girl, he discovers that she's actually in full command of European literature and feuilletonism and so on. So that, I suppose, is a great example of where the thing starts and how the thing as well has been contradicted and subverted, even as early as 1806, you know.
But it's still in the back of my mind, maybe it's my romanticism, but there is a sense that it starts off with that dream. Everything does. And then you kind of reimagine it the closer you get to the reality. And in some way, poetry, writing, fiction, the work that you do as a prose writer, that it is, in effect, readjusting the relationships between the natural, physical, actual world and the dream world, the imagined world, that these two things are always in tandem. Or am I putting words in your mouth?
You know, many of the ideas of the West of Ireland have been shaped by holidays, weekends, summer holidays, fortnights in July and so on. When you come here, you have to endure a different kind of weather, a different season. And Sylvia Plath said this about Devon. She says, winter is the real test, you know. So I think part of the challenge really is to write not just about the fine days, but about winter as well. That's the challenge I set myself at the moment anyway.
I remember them well. The water table for Tom and Julie Kilroy. The house is floating on water. Rainwater, seepage off fields, rivers, thaw, the eventual sea. Maybe we're all floating. The house, moored like a boat in this one particular place, swears through days and nights when we're glued to the TV. The water table's rising. Soon, typewriter and microwave, chairs, teapots, family pictures, will float up into the trees and come to rest, like offerings around a holy well, glistening. Already I have seen the ground swell and foundation cracks settle. What exactly is it about this landscape that you find so imaginatively alluring?
Well, it's a big question, really, I suppose. Can I just sort of answer that question kind of indirectly?
Sure.
I think the West of Ireland isn't just one thing. I mean, it's really, you can think about it as different regions. I mean, there's something going on in South Kerry with let's say the Blasket literature and with the Kilreelic thing and with the Amergan Centre, and that's one zone, if you like. And then I would think about Connemara and the Aran Islands as an area that I suppose Tim Robinson has really put an imprint on with his writings and his witness and his maps. You go to Sligo, then of course you've got the Yeats country, which is something else again. So rather than just lumping it all as the West, or even parceling it all into west of the Shannon, I tend to think of it as different areas with different cultural imprints. And that's, after all, what makes these places. It's not just the inert rocks. Mm-hmm. It's the witness of people and what they have written, what they have painted, what they have sung, and so on. In the case of Mayo, I was aware when we were travelling on holiday, actually. We came west before I got the job here. We travelled from Dublin to Sligo. And then leaving Sligo, coming down to Mayo, I did feel as if I was leaving one sort of cultural territory to come to a different cultural territory. And for me at the time, I was actually writing about Robert Lloyd Prager's work. And of course, Prager had done the Clare Island Survey in Clew Bay. So it was almost as if I was leaving the Yeatsian territory and coming into another territory which was more imprinted by natural history, geology and science, yeah. A more secular kind of world, if you like. But I think looking more generally at the west of Ireland, I would have to say that the great cultural watershed there is between the Irish language, yes. and the English language. And that is something, of course, that Mayo shares with Donegal, with Galway, with Kerry, mm-hmm. as well. I suppose in my current preoccupations, I'm working in prose again, another prose project on the Nathans, and there is so much in the Irish language, especially in the record of place names, something similar to what Tim Robinson has described for the Aran Islands and mm-hmm. Connemara. But in the case of Mayo, I suppose there is the fact that the Irish language is very weak. And in the landscape I'm looking at, in the Nathans, in the Wild Nathan area, the vernacular is extinct, but there is still a considerable residual knowledge of the language in the place names. And the local people will still explain these names to you. They will translate them for you. So there is a considerable knowledge still there.
From Translations. But here I am, on the edge of things, where islands riddle all that can be seen, with tales made up of a world of stones, silence and dreams, which it took me, for better or worse, to stay away from, and send instead this letter, as the sites for sale keep going up, leaving a little room for the dedicated professional folk to slowly drain and renovate for the view looking west of another new estate. I'm coming to the Unrick Bull Cottage on Achill to meet John McHugh, the artist, and it's nice to be back here. It's a wonderful, wonderful space. And of course, as it turns out, Achill has put on its lights. It's a glorious evening. And the mountain behind the cottage is lit. It's fantastic. Hello, John. How are you?
You're welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you again.
You brought the good weather with you.
Come on, we'll
go. The midges are out.
The midges are out, indeed. John, are you from this area, from the Achill Island? Or?
Yes, I grew up here. My mother's from here, my father's from Leitrim, and I grew up here, moved away for a spell during my teens and later on in college, of course. But after college, I moved back here and been living here ever since, full time. It was a great place growing up as a kid. There was a great interest in traditional music and a great awareness of, in my case, visual arts. There was a great painter, Belfast man called Des Turner, who ran courses here all through the 60s and 70s when I was a kid. So I was always aware of visual arts, visual art painting as an activity. Later on then, of course, I learned the island had been an area of interest for artists, if you put it like that. The earliest paintings we know of are by Evans of Eton, and they're of Kimbay in 1838. Some watercolours, which now I think are in the National Gallery. After that, then, right through the 19th century, there's records of artists coming to the island. And, of course, right up to the early 20th century, where there was a bit of a revival on the island as part of the Gaelic revival. There was a summer school set up. And into that mix came Paul Henry, and he stayed here through the teens. At the same time, and overlapped with an American painter, Robert Hinry. So right through the 20th century, then right through the modernist period, artists came then in the 40s, 30s, 40s and 50s, then writers started to, we come across writers coming here, and perhaps the most famous is Graham Greene, again, who came in the summer for a couple of summers in the late 40s. And into that tradition then came Heinrich Böll in the mid-50s.
Which is where we're in his cottage. This is the house that he moved to. Clearly he was leaving behind the destruction and the chaos.
It is interesting. He made two pieces of work based here. That was his Irish Journal Diary, which started life as a series of essays. So that was in the 50s and 60s. He made a film for a German television. And after that, when he was here, he didn't write about the place at all.
It was like a retreat for him.
It was like a working space.
Yeah. And did he have a connection with the people around him? Did they know him, or did he just...
Yes, they did know him and liked him. I mean, there are accounts of him being in the bars, but also there was accounts of him being always on time for mass. One lady said to her kid, you know, you need to be going now, Mr. and Mrs. Böll are gone up to mass, so you're going to be late.
That's a detail that I don't know too many people know about. But I'm curious, too, about his sense of the island, or even put that the other way around. I mean, is there a special kind of island consciousness? Is there something here that has drawn writers, artists like yourself, or is it just being here and living a life here?
Of course, there's a great tradition of here in Ireland and here in Europe, and it's very visible in America as well, of artists and writers going to islands to work or to escape, looking for something, looking for a kind of... And what I think it is, actually, is a kind of a society in miniature, you know.
So, like, the artists, the writers that were living here over the last, say, 50, 60 years, up to the present, and... You know, the life that this house inhabits in terms of flood of writers, musicians, artists.
Well, I see, like, the residency here. So the residency is every 2-3 weeks there's a new writer or painter. I see it as continuing that tradition that we can document back to our friend Evans of Eton, that tradition of the area being of interest to artists and writers, right up through Heinrich Böll. And it's continuing now, using the cottage as a facility, hosting a residency for writers and artists. But it's also good for the island, because it exposes the island to continuous contemporary writers and artists. So it's not simply looking back all the time in a kind of a heritage or a nostalgic way. It's looking to the future. And when people come here, often the island or references to the island creep into their work. And the island's reputation, if you like, filters out into writers and painters and musicians through their work.
So here I am at the end of a journey, meeting friends and colleagues, talking about the West of Ireland and what it means to writers and painters. Literally just sitting here looking out from Achill, the coast of Achill. It's quite a dramatic moment. The sun's high in the sky, the tide's coming in, and the mountains all around are glowing with the mist. It's the kind of thing that really, in the old use of the word, is awesome. But you can't help think about not just landscape and the natural world, but also the people who grew up in this environment. What a hardy folk they were to survive in this beautiful but harsh landscape. Many of them left, emigrated, moved to different parts of the world and came back. One of the other things, I suppose, that has meant a lot to me in my own life, looking back over these 45 years of living and travelling through the West of Ireland, has been the number of writers and artists who have settled here and made such a contribution to the place. But also those who maybe didn't spend that much time here, but obviously had a tremendous sense of the place. And of those, Heinrich Böll, the great
German Nobel laureate, comes to mind. And the cottage that he has left behind for writers from all over the world to come and stay and work in. I was lucky enough to stay in that cottage several years ago. And the day I was leaving, I noticed a little letter that was there, a letter that was left in the study. And I read it. It was in German, but there was a translation set alongside it. And the last two sentences of the letter stuck with me. So many, many months later, when I was thinking back on my time here and, more importantly, Ulrich Boll's time here, this poem emerged, which I called Crossing the Sound. Driving to the island, we crossed the Sound. Cathedral cliff, deserted village, Protestant mission. A spider's web, bleached in what sun there's been, stretches in a window of your home from home. Heaven knows the tales you left behind of war and soldiering, cities razed to the ground. I find a picture of the man in a beret, his laughing, furrowed face, and a letter that says, in a couple of days, we will watch shark fishing. We are very happy here.
Crossing the Sound was presented by Gerald Daw. The producer was Claire Cunningham, and the programme was a Rockfinch production for RTE Lyric FM. And that broadcast was in memory of the poet who died earlier this year. And that programme was made with support from Cumasún na mBan's Sound and Vision Broadcasting Funding Scheme from the television licence fee. It's available to podcast from the RTE Radio app, from the Lyric FM website, and from other podcast platforms. You can contact the Lyric feature by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.